Welcome to Radio Oldies, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is the critic, award-winning journalist and author, Amanda Craig. As one of our only female State of the Nation novelists, focusing on the widening gulf between the haves and have-nots in today's Britain, she's been compared with Balzac, Trollope and Dickens. She's said in interviews that she considers writing contemporary fiction a moral duty, and she now has several short story collections and 10 novels under her belt, including her latest High and Low, which was published in May. Amanda Craig, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you so much. It's a joy to be here.
Well, it's a delight to have you on, particularly as we've known each other a very long time, since we're at university together. Mm-hmm. So for those of us who haven't read it yet, I've read it, but for listeners who haven't, tell us a bit about High and Low, which is a searing indictment of the fast-emerging divisions in British society, causing the kind of riots we're beginning to see in, well, which we've just seen in Belfast, for example.
Yes, well, all over Britain. Well, it's very weird because I quite often have the experience of writing about a contemporary problem, which when I begin writing is just a mere speck on the far horizon, which then comes to pass. So I did this in a novel of mine called Hearts and Minds about the financial crash of 2008, and another novel called The Lie of the Land about Brexit and the division between town and country, and so on. And when I was writing High and Low, it was 2023, I could see that there was more and more anger about things like illegal immigration and, the indigenous, as it were, people of Britain feeling incredibly squashed and overlooked and oppressed, and that there was, you know, there were more and more little kind of fires springing up and fights. And I live in a very, what I might call, liminal, sort of edgy part of North London, which is a kind of bit between Kentish Town and Camden and Islington, sort of Keir Starmer land, you might call it. And I do kind of walk around a lot and talk to lots of people, and a social worker that I know told me that the street at the end of my road was known as Murder Mile. So I began to think, and I could see that where I lived, which is a very nice bit off Camden Square, sort of famous Victorian bit of Camden,
yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful old buildings. But just on the other side of the road, which is a big, busy road going down to King's Cross, there were lots of housing estates.
And those big blocks.
Those big blocks, yeah, where there's lots of trouble. And there was this little street of shops called Brecknock Road.
Yes.
Now, in my novel, High and Low, I didn't want to make it too kind of identifiable. But I have this area, which I call Prospect Park, which half of which is still kind of the lovely early Victorian buildings that have all been gentrified. And on the other side of Cross Street, this sort of dividing line, a gulf which literally has potholes, ever-growing potholes in the course of the novel that become this kind of sinkhole, are these housing estates. And I wanted to write about these two worlds which, over the course of 6 hours on a terrible winter's day, come into violent conflict with each other. And it's kicked off with a 12-year-old boy who's had a knife fight with his stepfather, and he's murdered his stepfather in self-defence, and he thinks he's murdered his mother, running away, and he's being pursued by a gang. But this gang is also at the heart of what then becomes an asylum hotel riot.
Yes.
So it's very violent, this novel.
It's violent.
Yeah, there are guns, there are knives, there are murders. There's also a lot of jokes, a lot of laughter, because ultimately the action centres on not just the little street of shops, which is under siege. It is a siege novel inspired by a famous 1970s film called The Assault on Precinct 13.
Oh, gosh, yes.
But, yeah, very famous. This literary cafe, where there is a little group of writers, this being North London, who all hate each other and are feuding with each other, who are going there to try and write. So it becomes this thing of, you know, are these North London types, you know, some of them, you know, quite left wing or pretending to be, are they actually going to help this poor boy who's on the run?
And well, they would claim to, wouldn't they?
They would claim to.
Classic liberal.
Classic liberal, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, not all of them are like this. Or are they going to save their own skins and give him up? And I thought that was a really interesting moral dilemma to have. And they also rather like this real life cafe that's nearly, you know, half of the literary cafe is a cafe and the other half is a sourdough bakery. And the bakers in the sourdough bakery, you gradually work out, are not what they appear. So there's lots of jokes in this book. It's not just a dark book. It's not going to make you feel worse by the time you finish it than you did when you started it. But it is going into places that most writers don't seem to go into.
It's really interesting what you say about the novel being dark, because you do have a great sense of the ridiculous. You quite often in your novels talk about this can't really be happening. It's just the world is so topsy-turvy. It's just bonkers, really, and you can't take it too seriously.
Well, you have to laugh. I mean, you know, one of my great heroes, Nabokov, said laughter is the best pesticide, and you know, I think it really is. And modern life is so full of pests. Yeah, you have to laugh, but at the same time, terrible things do happen, and ordinary people like, you know, you and I and everybody listening have to find a way to cope with them.
Yeah. You are absolutely, you know, your novels are so often about polarisation, you know, the ones you've set in Devon and Cornwall and things, where there's just this, you know, rich people come buying up all the properties and all the people who live there being edged out and all that sort of thing. And we are recording this on the day of the Macclesfield by-election, which is really, couldn't be more
appropriate. Yes, yes. And, you know, and it's not, by the way, that I think all rich people are evil. Far from it. I mean, I am genuinely, I think, you know, even-handed. I don't think that everybody right-wing is evil. I don't think everybody left-wing is purer than pure.
There is definitely... Since we were young together at university, the gap has widened.
It's worse.
There wasn't anything like the kind of wealth we're seeing now, nor the kind of poverty. It's just gone
more and more to extremes. Yes, no, I so agree. I mean, what I realise now, being, you know, in our generation, you know, we were the beneficiaries of that wonderful post-war
free education.
You know, it was just a sort of kinder, more civil society, wasn't it? More law-abiding, you know, more equal. You know, people had a really good functioning NHS, a good police service, you know, and all of that.
Opportunities.
Yes, if you were lucky enough to go to university, or even if you didn't, you know, you could get a job. You could get a home in your 20s. And start a family, and all that is going. So, yeah, this High and Low is very much a novel about rage. In order to counter this rage, you do need to take courage. You need to, you know, find your moral centre and fight for it.
Well, talking of that, that's brilliant, because you take me on to my next point, because you have said you think it's a moral duty to write contemporary literature. So you've got no truck with anything historical or any of that.
No, I enjoy historical fiction. I love historical detective fiction, because, you know, that in its essence is some people like Laura Shepherd Robinson and Andrew Taylor and so on do it absolutely beautifully. But you know it's made up. You know that it's not pretending to be a real portrait. I'm afraid, you know, the writers that I do take a kind of dim view of are people like Hilary Mantel, who otherwise I, you know, admired a lot. You know, her portrait of Cromwell in Wolf Hall as a man who's so civilised that he never has to torture anybody. Absolute bollocks! Holbein saw it all. This man was a butcher. You know, he was absolutely doing the worst things you can imagine. And I hate that. I hate that. Lying about the past. The past was awful, you know, and it stank. It was full of cruelty and misery and oppression. And we've been sold this idea that the past, particularly in Britain, was something that we should be nostalgic for.
Yeah.
No, we shouldn't.
No. So now, but going back to the idea of your moral duty as a novelist.
Yeah.
To
tell the truth.
Mm.
Yeah, fiction is the lie that tells the truth. And I think that's, it's a very hard thing to live with. Doesn't mean to say that you've got to be gloomy about the present or think that we're all doomed at all. I mean, in many ways, life now is better for most of us than it's ever been. You know, we're not in constant agony. We have, even in London, you know, less polluted air. We have certainly, one would hope, less misogyny and less injustice.
Well, up to a point.
No, it is better. I mean, one of the people I particularly admire and I count as a fellow State of the Nation novelist is this chap, Meg Herron, who's done the Slow Horses books, which, you know, they're spy thrillers. But they're also absolutely about the way we live now.
Yeah.
And you know, all the stuff that's going wrong. And he's hilariously funny.
Yes, he is.
And he's one of the few people who's doing what, you know, I'm trying to do, which is to tell a story with, you know, really strong characters and strong dilemmas and give people a jolly good ride, but also be very honest about the stuff that's what's going on. Yeah.
Mm.
And it's not journalism. I think that's the other thing people get wrong. You know, it's, this is not reporting on stuff. I mean, I do take enormous care to try and be accurate, even in my invented Prospect Park. You know, the details of it, you know, are true.
I used to be a documentary filmmaker, and I've made films in that area, in those blocks. So I
those very blocks. Yeah,
yeah,
so,
lots of gangs there, and
things. And people are afraid, you know, even, you know, doctors on call will not go there. They're too frightened to go. You know, it's still pretty grim.
Yeah.
Very gruesome. And even worse, the social housing that's falling down. I mean,
yes.
I do have, you know, this whole group of people in High and Low who are living in, you know, these brutalist blocks that, you know, the sewage is erupting out of taps. I know that's happening. I've been in flats where that's happening. You know, it's not just that they're rats and rubbish. The lifts don't work. There's syringes in the green spaces. But actual sewage, and nobody is sorting it out.
When did you start writing? Because you grew up in Italy.
I grew up in Italy, yes. I mean, I wrote a lot of very bad poetry as a teenager. I don't know if that would count. I mean, I began writing when I was at Cambridge, really, and I was sort of trying to teach myself. But I think, in the end, the only way you learn to write is by doing it. Reading a lot, always. And writing a lot. And gradually, you get better.
But do you feel a bit gloomy about that? Do you think we're the last generation who did read a lot? I mean, we didn't have phones, so...
I don't know. There are still people who do read. I mean, my daughter, Leon Craig, is also a novelist, and she reads everything too. And she has a whole cohort of friends who are also reading. I mean, I don't know how much they're reading of the great Victorian novelists, Trollope and Dickens and all those people who are kind of your and my model, perhaps, for... Yeah. Great fiction,
the big canvas
and the mixture of high and low, the mixture of comedy and tragedy, and observation and fantasy, and style and what you might call substance, you know, all of those things. I think the kind of fiction that tends to get prizes and you know, reviews in the Times now either tends to be this maddening stuff by American women living in Maine about, you know, their families and frankly quite boring middle class lives, or Irish, and the Irish thing is a whole other story, which is really
enlightened.
Well, you know, she's good, but you know, the Sally Rooney's, the thing is, Ireland, you know, bully for them, is having this great literary renaissance because it's been funded by the Arts Council, and they've got these writers' magazines like The Stinging Fly, which, you know, probably most of your listeners haven't even heard of, but it's hugely supportive of new writing in a way we are not.
Ireland, because it always had tax breaks. Because I remember as a child, my parents had all these friends in Ireland. We were always visiting, like Len Dayton. You know, they all moved to Ireland because they didn't pay any tax.
Yeah, and I know one or two very successful writers who have refuse to move to Ireland because they feel it's their duty to pay taxes. You know, they're very, you know, they're in the kind of top 0.1% and they've made millions. And I think that's really honourable of them. I mean, J.K. Rowling, for example, yeah. you know, has, yeah. could be even richer.
Yeah.
But she stays in Scotland, she pays her taxes, she funds women's refuges, and she's a thoroughly good egg. Anyway, High and Low is actually a direct sequel to A Vicious Circle 30 years later. Yeah. So many of the same characters reappear 30 years yes. on. So there's a character called Ivo Sponge, yes. who everybody loves to hate, who's a very kind of jolly right-wing, slightly awful editor of a national newspaper, but who was a journalist in A Vicious Circle. There is Mark Crawley's daughter, who was a baby called Rose, who now is a mother herself with the baby. And there's this Irish woman called Mary Quinn, who is a heroine of A Vicious Circle, who absolutely plays an important part in High and Low. So there are these various characters. I do carry characters on from one novel to the next. You don't need to read all of them
That's
to enjoy them.
Very Trilopian.
And that was who I learned it from. Trilopian. Yes. That was exactly who I learned it from. So minor characters become major and vice versa. But in this, you know, the major characters in A Vicious Circle are also major characters in High and Low. And that was really fun because it became also somewhat a meditation on middle age. You know, then, and those people who had been in their very early 30s are now in their very early 60s, and they've got children of their own. And in Mary Quinn's case, you know, dying to have grandchildren, which many of us are. So that was the sort of fun bit, and I think, you know, people who've read both will definitely get, you know, even more out of High and Low than they would if they just read it on its own.
No, I agree. I absolutely loved it. And I'm just interested as well, sort of slightly going back to the J.K. Rowling theme.
Mm.
You've been a great champion of children's literature. Massive.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people think you're responsible really for recognising and boosting the likes of J.K. Rowling and all.
Oh, no, no, I wouldn't say that in her case. But I was very, very lucky in that, you know, when I was... it was partly that I was very ill at the time, but when I had young children, I did think, well, children's books are actually a literary form in their own
yes.
right and they should be reviewed seriously. So I did begin and I did give Harry Potter one of its very first tiny reviews, and I really made a fuss about people like Philip Pullman
yes.
and Cresta Cowell, How to Train Your Dragon and The Hunger Games. I mean, I was really lucky. It sort of coincided with this great flowering in children's literature, which sadly now has rather died away.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, I think a lot of it's demographic. You know, people can't afford to have children at the moment. There's just less.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Yeah, there are just fewer children to satisfy. And I think also our generation, now in their 60s, was so lucky because we had the second golden era of children's books. So we had people like Joan Aiken and Geoffrey Treece and, you know, these wonderful, wonderful writers of the 1960s and 70s, and people like Hergé's Tintin,
yeah.
you know, translated. So I think we and our passion for reading very much were forged by those writers. So I'm hopeful that the millennials, you know, people like my daughter and son who are now in their 30s, they have caught the reading bug and it won't altogether disappear, despite what everybody fears with phones and social media.
Are you optimistic then about the future of books generally? Quite
fairly. I'm moderately optimistic. I think we need a lot more support. I mean, we really, really, really need people who love books to use their public libraries and to buy books. Please, please buy books
yes.
because that, you know, without money, we will definitely die. And and the money is less and less and less.
Mm.
And that really is absolutely key. I do get very sad when people, you know, I mean, things like Kindles, I know they're very useful, particularly if your eyesight isn't what it was. But authors get practically nothing from Kindle sales.
What about Audible?
Audible is much better, yes. Mm. So, yes, if you want to do that, that is very helpful. But the single most helpful thing for authors to buy a book, particularly, I'm afraid, a hardback.
Yeah.
Hardbacks are the things that really, you know, pay for most of what an author and a publisher need.
Expensive.
They are expensive, I agree, you know, but everything is expensive.
Everything is expensive.
You go to out for a meal in a pub,
yes.
You know, my book costs £20, a meal in a pub is going to cost you at least 30.
Actually, it's so true, and talking about meals, our cookery correspondent is called Elizabeth Luard.
Ooh.
And
she's, wonderful writer.
She's absolutely wonderful, and she the other day, I went, in fact, to talk to her on Radio Aldi, and she'd just been to a bookshop. And she was saying, isn't it incredible how many books I managed to buy for whatever it was, you know, £40. Mm. Look at this wealth of reading I managed to buy. And that's so much more worthwhile than, as you say, having a meal in a restaurant or something. So if it's a way of looking at it, isn't it? Not, ooh, £20 is a lot of money on a hardback, but...
Yes.
Wow, the hours of joy it's going
to
give me.
Yes, and you can give it to someone else and give them joy too. You know, so it's not something like a meal, which once you've had it, just disappears onto your waistline.
So what are you doing next?
Well, I've got several books on the boil. I'm just writing a little book at the moment, not for my usual publisher, but Notting Hill Editions, on modern marriage. Because I've become very fascinated. I was rung up by this woman who said, I just want to commission any book from you. You and Julian Barnes, she said, so I was very flattered, on any subject that interests you. And I said, well, you know, I am very interested by how marriage has changed.
How long have you been married? Years.
Oh, 40 years?
Gosh.
Yeah,
and I've never been married, so there we are.
Oh, my goodness.
So come on, carry on. This is
fascinating. No, well, that's the thing, that, you know, you don't need to be married anymore, which, you know, when we were growing up, that was the expected. You know, you weren't expected particularly to have a career, even if you'd been to university.
Yeah.
And that all changed when we were in our early 20s. But I'm fascinated by the way that you don't need to be married anymore, and yet 40% of people still are. That, thank God, the stigma of being illegitimate, born outside marriage, no longer lasts.
No, it means nothing.
That means that unless you're a member of the aristocracy and want to inherit a title, in which case I'm afraid you can't. But also the way that all sorts of things have been shoved onto marriage that I think make it sort of buckle under the strain that... You know, your partner in marriage is, well, I'll say, you know, you must buy the book. But I think that people expect things from their spouse that perhaps they didn't in previous generations. Well, your spouse has to be, you know, your psychotherapist, your cheerleader, your...
Everything. Yes,
and you
need
to
decide what you need, don't you? Because no one person can give you everything.
Yeah.
And we've all got lots of friends, so you go to that person for that and that.
Yeah.
But that's what I found. People seem to expect you to deliver the works.
The works, everything. And to be...
And cook on top.
And to cook.
And clean.
And drink. Pick up the socks and all the rest of it. Yes. And, you know, if you're a feminist, as of course you and I both are, that's also very interesting because how do you negotiate those expectations with being, you know, a breadwinner and an independent person? So all of this interests me a lot.
When's that coming out and what's it called?
It's still going to be called Modern Marriage. So it'll just be a little tiny book. You know, people will be able to put it in their Christmas stockings next year. So
2027?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But there are lots of other things I'm thinking about. And one of them, obviously, because the other thing that I've spoken up a lot about in the media, besides children's books, always a happy subject, is a very unhappy subject, which is trans and this bullying by the trans lobby. And I've had... really a lot of aggravation being very outspoken about this.
And you have not been cancelled for many
and I have not
festivals,
been,
I hope.
Well, I don't know. I think I have. I think I've definitely been cancelled by the BBC because I always used to be interviewed on things like Woman's Hour and Front Row. And the last two novels I haven't been. And, you know, these novels are some of the best books I've ever written and... The Three Graces, which was reviewed in The Oldie by lovely Mary Killen a couple of years ago.
We love Mary Killen.
We love Mary Killen, especially after that. Mm-hmm. The Three Graces being developed for a TV series, and there has been total radio silence on, literally, as it were, on the BBC.
Do you have an agent who sort of makes these phone calls and inquiries for you then?
That's kind of difficult.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people in publishing and agenting were also very intimidated by this movement. I mean, I think it's slightly less bad now than it was, but people were not brave about standing up to this stuff.
But I think there was so much cancel culture going on. So, you know, wonderful Bailey Gifford sponsored
us. Yes.
Because they were sacked by Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah, well, exactly. Those are the festivals I've not... And the Edinburgh Festival, which I always used to do as well. No, absolute lunacy. And wonderful Bailey Gifford. You know, the people who actually... Of all the people...
Love culture
love
and literature.
Books, yes. Yeah. They're mad, these people.
I know.
Yes, absolutely
anyway,
mad.
Our game.
What? Yes, absolutely. How marvellous of them. I didn't know that. And hooray for Bailey Gifford, because... Yes, no, really, really bad stuff, that. So I am thinking that I might write a novel about this.
Oh.
Not immediately.
Trans stuff.
The trans stuff and cancel culture, yes.
Oh.
Because, you know, it's another thing that I think is still quite a hot-button topic, as they say in America. And I think, you know, things have moved on enough for... I hope publishers not to be absolutely terrified. You know, one of the changes in this whole business, I'm afraid to say, because I absolutely loathe him, was Trump.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's been said, and I think probably correctly, that a lot of people voted for Trump because the Democratic side was pro-trans. And if Kamala Harris had won, you know, the cancel culture would have just... swept America with 10 times more force, as it has in Canada.
So
these are very, very awful, serious things. But you can see that, you know, it will take quite a lot of thinking. And also, when you're addressing something like this, you know, it's like in High and Low, this, you know, the terrible gap between rich and poor. What you cannot and must not do is have a polemical... lecture, you know, you mustn't moralise at the reader.
No.
You must let the reader feel for both sides.
Both sides, yeah.
And that's the thing, both sides.
Yeah.
So,
well, I hope you carry on doing what you're doing because
your books
are fabulous.
Oh, thank you,
and Amanda. Thank you very, very much for coming on Radio Old. It's been lovely to talk to you.
It's lovely to talk to you too, Charlotte. Absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Amanda Craig. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. In the meantime, my very warm thanks to you again, Amanda, to Bailey Gifford, Actual Investors, for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Bailey Gifford, Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.